If you live in the Philadelphia area and you watch the news on Friday nights, you know that it's Friday flyby, right? Friday night is when you get to see the high school football games. And the helicopter flies over top of the field, and it shows you one of the plays, and then gives you a little bit broader overview of what the game was like. This seminar is going to be a little bit like First Peter flyby. Okay, we're going to do connections, we're going to look at the themes, and occasionally we're going to drop down, and we're going to look at one of the plays. But the broader purpose is to give you the kind of overview that you'll need as you look at the book for your own benefit, or as you look at the book for ministry. By way of introduction, let me talk about a few people that I've gotten to know in counseling. First group of folks that I've gotten to know are people who have made a lot of mistakes relationally, and they've paid the price. These are people who did the wrong thing, and they suffered the consequences for it. I've known men who have brutalized their wives with their words, and consequently, they've driven their wives away. I've talked to parents and friends of drug addicts who no longer trust that person because of the many times that they've been lied to. These are people who have done the wrong thing relationally, and they pay the price for it. And that kind of makes sense, okay? If you do the wrong thing, people tend not to be drawn to you. The consequences of strained and ruined relationships make sense. I also know people who have done the right things in relationships, and they reap the benefits. I know husbands who have repented of ignoring their wives, who have done simple things around the house, like initiating a conversation or helping out around the house, and they've just seen their wives respond very positively. I've seen people who have done small acts of kindness. They've sent a birthday card. They've called a friend. They've invited a friend to go do something, and a relationship that formerly was on the rocks blossoms, and it flourishes. These are people who do the right things relationally, and they reap the benefits. And you also expect that, okay? You show an interest in somebody else, and they tend to reciprocate. It makes sense. I also know people, however, who have done the right thing relationally, and they pay a price for it. I know people who confess sin to their spouses, who are then ostracized in their own homes. I know a young lady who cared deeply about her husband, with good motives. Her heart was in the right place. She made nice meals. She wore things her husband liked. She went places with him. She even slept with him. And nothing that she did would change his hatred of her. I know husbands who serve, who give of themselves to the point of exhaustion, and they're belittled and treated contemptuously by their wives. I know people who have done the right thing, and they've paid a price for it. That seems odd. It's not what you expect. It doesn't make sense. These people start to ask, well, what did I do wrong? It's an easy move from there to, well, why bother? Why should I keep trying? Have you ever felt like that? Like, why should you try anymore? It doesn't make sense to you to be treated the way that you're being treated. And if you're on the other side of the table trying to help someone like this, your heart breaks for them because you see them doing good and receiving evil. It's that kind of suffering, receiving evil for doing good, that's the focus of Peter's first letter. You see, he's not dealing with suffering in general. Other books in the Bible do that, like Job. His concern is that you understand how to live well when people respond badly to you. Peter says that's part of the normal Christian life. You're going to suffer at the hands of other people when you obey Christ, when you do the right thing. It's not as unusual as you might think. And he wants to make sure that you're not caught off guard, that you're not caught by surprise. And he wants you to understand where you can expect to suffer. You can expect to suffer in relationships. As you read through the book of 1 Peter, you realize he talks an awful lot about relationships. He talks about masters and slaves, husbands and wives, governing authorities both in and out of the church. He even talks about your neighbors. And you realize that the book is packed with relationships, and it's in each one of those important relationships that the potential for suffering is right on the surface. And it's there because of your Christian faith. Peter claims that people are going to sin against you because you desire to live like a Christian in your relationship with them. They won't understand you, and they might not like you because of the ways that Christ calls you to relate to them. And in turn, they're going to misuse their authority, they're going to misuse the relationship, and they're going to hurt you. For your part, you'll be tempted to sin and do evil when you suffer at their hands. Peter says you're going to be tempted to cover up wrong things that you've done that you should bring out into the open. Peter says you're going to be tempted to retaliate. You're going to be tempted to trade insults with others when they're mean to you. Peter says you'll be tempted to put your confidence in a pretty face to win somebody over. And maybe most of all, you'll be tempted to be afraid of the power that other people have. You'll be tempted to withdraw from them and from doing what is right and good. And with all those temptations, Peter asks you, what are you going to do? Are you going to handle the reality of relationships that make you suffer with faith? Peter understands relationships are always costly. They're often rewarding, but they almost certainly always cost you more than you had intended. However, Peter realizes that being a Christian raises that price. He says, not only is your Christianity a catalyst for the reaction that you get, it also limits the response that you can give. You're not able to react the way that others do, or in the way that might come easily and naturally to you. So how are you going to handle the reality of guaranteed suffering because of your love for the Lord? Will you give in to temptation, or will you walk in faith? Let's look at that second point in your outline and understand a little bit better how a Christian lifestyle makes relationships more difficult. First, you're not able to go along with everything that other people want you to do anymore. At one point in chapter 4, Peter says, you used to dive right in. You used to join your friends in what they wanted you to do. But now you don't. And now they're confused. They think it's strange that you don't join them. All right, confusion is okay. You can live with that. You can live with people not quite understanding you. But it doesn't end there. You wind up being ostracized from others. They don't understand you, and now they don't want you. You stop getting the social invitations you used to get. Colleagues at work stop dropping by your office. Neighbors find other friends for their kids to play with. And you're no longer included. You're ostracized. Or, stepping down the continuum a little bit, the stance that you're taking invites ridicule. Okay, ostracism is difficult because it excludes you. Ridicule is difficult because it attacks you. Peter loads his letter with examples of things that, for want of a better term, we might call verbal abuse. He says people will speak maliciously against you. They'll heap abuse on you. They'll insult you. They'll accuse you. They'll talk ignorantly about you. The things that they say are intended to harm you on the inside. They'll ridicule you. But it goes worse. You take another step down from ridicule, and you invite pressure, you invite coercion from others. They don't like the stance that you take in life, and so they feel the need to pressure you to change. Sometimes it takes an overt form where you're told not to be so rigid in your thinking. Other times it's a little more covert. They'll dangle a promotion in front of you if you just go along with the game this time. They'll find ways to pressure you to get you to be different. And if you resist that pressure, you may actually be harmed. Now, in the context that Peter's writing about, when he's writing about persecution, we tend to think in terms of physical harm. And then we look at our lives as Americans and we think, well, you know, physical harm isn't really something I'm worried about. And so First Peter seems a little bit further away from us. But let's see if we can broaden that category just a little bit. You see, if you don't go along with your boss because of your Christian faith, not only do you face ridicule and pressure for your beliefs, but you might be fired, and you might face financial harm. And you recognize that harm for the sake of Christ can take multiple forms. And so none of these areas that Peter's going to talk about are strange to you. You all face the potential for suffering in your relationships when you set out to live in a manner worthy of Christ. A second way in which being a Christian makes relationships difficult is that I have a calling from Christ to respond well to others when they act wrong. I'm supposed to do good to them. When other people sin against me, I'm not permitted to indulge in bitterness, animosity, quarreling, slander, or revenge. Instead, I'm to remain focused on what would be good for them, even when they treat me badly or make my life difficult. I'm supposed to honor and respect those in authority, even when I disagree with their politics, or their personalities, or their lifestyles. I'm not allowed to talk badly about them, and I'm not allowed to teach other people to speak disrespectfully of them. Instead, I'm supposed to honor them. I'm supposed to obey them when doing so doesn't run against Christ's law. More broadly, I set out intentionally to do good to others. It's not enough to have an absence of evil in my life. I'm also supposed to have an abundance of good. I return blessing when I'm cursed. Now, please note, little caveat here. I'm not saying that I've got a calling to be a doormat, and so I let other people walk all over me when that's convenient for them. Doing good for others can mean speaking up in ways that they don't really want to hear, or it can mean setting limits that are necessary. The difference, according to Peter, is that I do so not out of fearfulness for myself, but when I speak up, when I set limits, I do so out of a ministry concern of doing good for someone else. You know, if I pause here and think for a moment, this Christian thing is starting to sound unattractive. If I understand Peter correctly, I have this calling from Christ to do good to people, I can expect to suffer in return, and I get to do good again. I'm not wired that way naturally. And so if I'm going to keep on going down this path, I'm going to need some kind of incentive to do so. I'm going to need some kind of motivation to continue walking along with Peter. And Peter provides that under the next point in your outline. Because with the themes of talking about suffering for doing good in the middle of relationships, Peter keeps talking about a wonderful life, talks about a glorious hope. And you start to wonder, well, how can you put those two things together? And the way that he does is he keeps talking about Christ. He keeps talking about God the Father. He keeps talking about the Holy Spirit. And it's that connection that forms the linchpin for his book so that he can talk about both of those other pieces in the same book. We'll deal with this thinking about what Peter says about God in the past, the present, and the future. Let's start with the past. Over and over, Peter keeps reminding you of what Jesus has already done for you. In chapter 1, verse 3, he has caused you to be born again to a living hope through the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead. Chapter 1, verses 18 to 19, he ransomed you from your futile ways of life with the precious blood of Jesus. Chapter 2, verse 21, Christ suffered for you and bore your sins in his body. Chapter 2, 24 and chapter 3, 18. And you start to get this sense that the past work of Christ is very important for you in the present. It's not simply something that happened 2,000 years ago, but for Peter, it occupies a front and center role, even as he talks about these other difficult people in your life. As Peter talks about how difficult people can make your life presently, he never forgets how wonderful that present life is because of how Christ has transformed it. To put it more colloquially, Peter is not a Philadelphia Eagles fan. He doesn't approach Christ with an attitude of, "What have you done for me lately?" Instead, he reminds you of what Christ has already done for you. And he claims that what he did for you in the past was so huge that it comes right into the present. It's here and now. It affects you as you interact with difficult people. How does it do that? Well, first, what Jesus has already done for you makes you who you are now. It gives you an identity. Our identity as people is not defined by the people around us. Our identity is defined by who Christ has made us. We're now God's. We belong to him and to his people. And that's the circle where we fit in. Even if we don't fit in anywhere else in this universe, we fit in with God's people and his plans. Ultimately, that means that we're part of the only in crowd that matters. It's the only in crowd that matters because it's the only in crowd that lasts for all eternity. In other words, I don't need to be upset or anxious because I don't fit in with the people around me, because I know that I have a secure place where I already fit. Secondly, because Jesus has made us part of his family, we have a new lifestyle. How I live on this earth is not dictated by the people around me and how they want me to act, nor is it dictated by how I'd like to respond to others. Instead, Jesus set an example for us so that we might no longer live in sin, because we're now dead to obeying sin and we're alive to obeying righteousness. Chapter 2, verses 21 to 24. Because of what Jesus did in his death and resurrection, we're now free to live out a lifestyle that reflects heaven instead of hell. Let me give you an example of this. When I was in college, people would ask me, "How are you doing?" And I realized over time that when someone asked me, "How are you doing?" I had one of two answers. For my friends from InterVarsity, the answer that I would give involved my faith. I'd talk about the Lord and what he was doing in my life. And I'd talk about the difficulties in life and the opportunities, but it was all about what God was up to. When a guy on the dorm floor asked me how I was doing, I'd talk about the difficulties and the opportunities. And talk an awful lot about my faith. And over time, I started to realize, you know what, I need to be one person with one answer, regardless of who asks me. Well, if you're going to be one person with one answer, what do you need? You need courage. Where do you get courage? This may be reading a little bit more sophistication onto my life than I had at that point in time, but you get courage by knowing who you belong to right now. And because you know that you already belong, you have the courage to answer honestly with one answer when people ask you, "How are you doing?" You have the courage because it doesn't really matter whether they like the answer that I give or whether they don't like the answer I give. The person I belong to likes the answer I give. For Peter, Christ's death and resurrection are present realities. They orient him to what's important. The past shapes, Christ's past actions shape who Peter is, and they shape how he deals with suffering and potentially difficult relationships. Okay, here's the first soul-searching question of the workshop. When you suffer, how important to you is Christ's death and resurrection? Is it in the front of your mind? It is for Peter. Or is it in the back of your mind, or is it not in your mind at all? See, Christ's death and resurrection influence how Peter handles suffering in the present. Peter doesn't only think about the past, however, he also talks about the present. And there's several benefits that we could talk about. I want to focus in on verse 14 of chapter 4. If you are insulted for the name of Christ, you are blessed. That's kind of an odd statement, isn't it? If you're insulted for the name of Christ, you're blessed. It kind of begs the next question, well, how is that? Which Peter answers. He says, because the Spirit of glory and of God rests on you. Did you catch what he just said? The Spirit of glory and of God rests on you when you are insulted for the name of Christ. Now, I owe this insight to Dan McCartney in his book, Why Does It Have to Hurt? It's available down at the RCL book table. But what Peter is trying to get at here is you connect relationally with God in a special way when, because of your love for him, you wind up suffering at the hands of someone else. Make sure you see the picture. Okay, there's this person right in front of you, and you realize that what you're about to do or what you're about to say has the potential of bringing suffering on you. And yet there's also Christ in your world. And because of your love for Christ, you're willing to say something that brings suffering back to you because the Spirit of Christ and of God rests on you at that moment. There's a close connection with Christ that happens when you're willing to suffer for his sake. In that moment, Christ moves closer to you. He sees what your love for him costs you. And he says to you, "I will make it up. I will make up the difference by giving you myself." And here you see God's heart. We know that his people matter to him, that he cares for us. But the people who suffer for his sake really matter to him. When you're willing to identify with him to your own hurt, God notices and draws near to you and is with you in a very special way. Now, that's a bit hard for some of us to swallow. Those of you who are like me, who prefer relationships that are easy and comfortable, that don't have any tension, you and I need to make sure we don't miss Peter's inference here. Because when you and I choose not to act in a way that honors Christ, because it means that we'd get that suffering, what we're actually preferring is not to have his Spirit rest on us. We're saying, whatever this relationship offers me, or whatever is important to me in this relationship, is of more value to me than having Christ's presence and having him be close to me. That only makes sense. If I choose to be friends with someone by reducing my commitment with Christ, clearly I don't value him very much. It's only at the point at seeing what it costs me that I realize how important it is to me to be God's friend. I was thinking, you know, I'm working through this, thinking about the workshop, and I'm realizing, well, I'm a Christian counselor. I work at a place called the Christian Counseling Center. People come to me for Christian counseling, and I'm thinking, you know, I don't run into this risk very much. And then I realized how foolish that thinking was, and realized that the personal ministry always involves this risk. Because sometimes when you're talking to people, you realize Christ wants to say something to this person, and they're not going to like it. And at that moment, how important is it to me to have Christ's presence come and dwell with me? Will I say what Christ wants me to say, or will I duck the suffering? At other times, you're absolutely sure that you need to hold back from saying something to somebody. They're not in the right place. Their hearts aren't ready. There's too many things they have to go through before they can hear something that's pretty hard. And yet you know that there's people in their lives who really want them to hear that hard stuff. Their family really wants you to lay your cards on the table with them. Their friends really want them to hear something hard. Their church really wants them to hear something hard. How important at that moment is it to you to have the Spirit of Christ rest on you if you might invite ridicule from the people around you? In addition to talking about the past and the present benefit of knowing Christ for walking through suffering, Peter also points you to the future. He says that you have an inheritance kept in heaven for you, chapter 1, verse 4. You rejoice in your sufferings now because you know that you will rejoice and be glad when Christ's glory is revealed, chapter 4, verse 13. God will exalt you at the proper time, chapter 5, verse 6. And God himself will restore, confirm, strengthen, and establish you. Chapter 5, verse 10. Not only do we have a past that affects us in the present, not only do we have that present comfort and fellowship with Christ, brothers and sisters, we also have a future. And in the book of 1 Peter, that's not something that everybody can say. Because Peter is going to emphasize God is judge. God is a righteous judge. He cares intensely for his holiness. He cares intensely for righteousness. And he's got the power to back up his verdicts. Peter asks almost rhetorically in chapter 4, verse 17, if judgment begins with the family of God, then what will be the outcome for those who do not obey his gospel? In other words, many people don't have a future worth looking forward to. They almost have to focus on the present because the future for them is bleak. Not so for the people of God. We have a future that we look forward to and that motivates us in the present. Now, I'm not talking about some kind of faraway dream world that we run to and escape. I'm not talking about some little place in our minds that we try to run away from nasty people in and pretend that the horrible things going on around us aren't really there. I'm talking about something that is so real that it motivates you to keep on going through the difficult times in your life. The metaphor is much better if you think about that vacation that's coming up. Okay? Next month, you're taking a vacation. You have spent this entire last year planning for this vacation. You have done your research. You've put more money out than you thought was possible, and you have an ironclad guarantee that this is the best vacation that you've ever had, and it'll make everything else in your life pale by comparison. And because you know, in just 2 weeks' time, you're going on that vacation, you get up in the morning with a smile. You go to your office and you tack that pile of paperwork that never seems to disappear. You walk past other people's offices a little bit lighter because you know that what's coming is so wonderful. The difficulties of today just aren't that big a deal. They're there. It's not fun. You'd rather not go to work. But it's not that big a deal. What's that future going to be like? Peter claims that at that future point, God's going to set everything right. Listen to the words again. He will restore you. He will confirm you. He will strengthen you. He will establish you. In short, he will vindicate you. You're going to get back everything that you lost out of your loyalty to him. You're going to get it all back and more. Peter doesn't promise restoration necessarily in this lifetime. But he does promise that absolutely at some point, God will restore you. Whether we're talking about reputation, position, or even physical well-being. Do you get the picture? You don't serve a stingy God. This is a God who's generous with his motivations and his blessings. What he gives you, connection with him, inheritance, vindication, guaranteed future joy, those things more than make up for any suffering that you'll undergo on his behalf. And I think, brothers and sisters, that here's the point where we often sell God short. My experience is that we approach the Christian life as if it were primarily comprised of a list of onerous duties doled out by some cosmic killjoy. We then take that list of duties and we take it to another believer and say, here's what it is to serve Christ. Isn't this wonderful? We're a little odd sometimes in the way that we urge other people to obedience. Okay, it's almost like it's like the last hamburger on the barbecue grill. You all know the one, okay? You've turned the grill off about half an hour ago, and this burger's been flipped so many times it has ridges and valleys in it now. It's charcoaled, it's dry. The dog doesn't want it. The cheese is congealed all over the top of it, and you go to find a bun for it, and well, that's the bun that was on the ground that you wrestled the dog over. You put that on. And there's no ketchup, and you hand it to somebody and say, have a great hamburger. We do that with the Christian life. Well, I guess God's teaching me patience. Oh, good, I'd like him to teach me some of that too. Kind of goofy, the way that we approach the Christian life. God has his benefits, and he offers them to us. I think we often, we're afraid to put the incentives out there. Okay, God doesn't promise you a healthy life. He doesn't promise you a BMW in your driveway. In fact, he promises that you're going to suffer. But he says that there are such terrific incentives involved that not only make it possible to get through the tough times, the incentives are so great you're actually going to rejoice through them. So here's the question. And this is the question that the whole workshop turns around. If you miss this question, the rest of it doesn't make any, it won't matter to you. Here's the question. Do you believe it? Do you think that what he offers is worth the trouble involved? You've seen his track record. You've seen what he's done. You see what he offers in the present. You see what he promises for the future. Now, do you believe him? If you don't, then you won't take seriously what he says to do. You're not going to obey him when faced with difficult, demanding, or abusive relationships. And honestly, if you don't believe him, there's no sense in obeying him. It wouldn't make any sense. It only makes sense to live God's way if you believe that he is who he says he is and that he does what he says he does. It only makes sense to obey if you value what he holds out to you. And if you do believe him, then you're going to live contrary to your own natural inclinations. And you'll live contrary to the natural inclinations of the people around you. You're going to do and say things that are not natural. You're going to resist doing the normal, natural things. Out of love for your God, you'll do things that just don't make any sense, because you believe that he's able, that he's willing, and that he's big enough to get your back, and that you don't have to protect yourself. Okay? You're going to suffer. I'm sorry, but you're going to suffer. Here's the terrific things Christ offers you. Now what are you going to do? We'll spend our last several minutes thinking about what are you going to do. The first thing that you're going to do is you will make it a priority to look for what God is doing in your life more than you're concerned with what other people are doing. You see, suffering, especially relational suffering, tends to shut us down. It closes us into smaller and smaller rooms. We shut people out of our lives. We turn off all other relationships, including helpful ones. And in that moment, the hardest thing to do is to recognize that we have an unbelievable relationship offered to us that makes all the others pale in comparison. And it's that relationship with Christ that Peter urges you to focus on even more than on the one that's causing your suffering. That doesn't mean you ignore the people who brought suffering to you, but you understand that those people and their activities are always understood within the larger plans and purposes of God. So that means I need to learn how to prize him and my relationship with him more than I prize any other relationship. And in prizing that relationship, I have the resources that I need to extend myself to other people. Secondly, you trust Christ enough to obey him, even when you don't understand how come you're suffering the way that you are. Or to put it the other way around, you stop insisting on understanding the whole counsel of God before you decide it's a good idea to obey him. Okay, I was talking to a child once. This kid kept sitting on the back of her chair at school. And the teacher would come over to her and say, you need to get down. The kid would get down, sit regularly in the seat, but then forget and go back to sitting on the back of the chair. At one point, the teacher comes over to her and says, if you keep doing this, you're going to fall off the back of your chair and crack your head. Well, that seemed like a reasonable incentive to the child, who then remembered what the teacher was saying. Brothers and sisters, that is not obeying. What that is that the little girl happens to agree with the reason that the teacher gave her. And because she has decided on her own that it's a good reason, she no longer sits on the back of her chair. She didn't listen to the teacher because she respected the teacher. She didn't listen to the teacher because she trusted the teacher. She didn't listen simply because she believed, you know, the teacher, when she speaks, she's thinking good for me. I need to learn how to care about somebody even when I don't understand it. She decided to listen because she agreed with the reason. Too often, that's how we approach God. If he gives me a good enough reason, then I'll obey him. But if I don't understand from this point how it's going to look at the other end, I'm not going to obey him. Here's where you need to appreciate the fact that you might not ever have the full picture of what's taking place in your life. Now, I understand I'm stepping on toes. This is sort of one of those evangelical sacred cows. I get it. Okay? We've all said it. We've heard it. We've probably said it. I don't know what's going on in my life right now, but when I get to heaven, God will make it all clear to me. You know what? Maybe he will. Maybe he won't. See, when I read through the scriptures, I see that he promises to dry every tear. I don't remember reading the verse where he promised that he was going to explain every single one of his actions to my complete satisfaction. What God does give when he explains suffering are always the big picture answers. He doesn't promise to give us the little picture answers. What do I mean by that? When Peter hints at why things happen to you, those hints have more to do with the value of going through suffering than they do with giving you rock-solid reasons for why a certain unpleasant thing happened to you on a given particular day. The value that Peter holds out to you is that your faith is purified and your relationship with God is strengthened. I was talking with a young person once, done some pretty foolish things in his life, and in trying to do the right thing, just created a much bigger mess. wound up being sort of the target for other people in such a way that it literally ruined every area of his life. It touched every area of his life, and it was ongoing for a long period of time. And the refrain in this person's life is, why me? Why me? It's not a strange question. I think that makes a lot of sense when you're suffering. Why me? And yet his emphasis was on the little picture. What was it that made me the target of these other people? What did I do wrong so that I can fix that? And as we talked, I invited him to consider the bigger picture of what God is doing. I invited him to remember that not only were these people involved, but so also was his God. His God who loved him, who was concerned for him, and who yet allowed this stuff to take place. And so we came at the why me question a little bit differently. I said, let's put that on hold for a moment and ask instead, what has changed in your life since this event took place? And very quickly, he focused on his relationship with the Lord, a relationship that had grown much more vibrant over a fairly long period of time. He wanted to walk more closely with Christ. His faith mattered to him. It had become purified. It had been tested and was becoming even more purified. And we talked about what his relationship with Christ had been like previously. And he described over a period of years a relationship that was being strangled, a relationship that was growing dim, that really didn't have any effect on his day-to-day life. A relationship that he described metaphorically as, you know, God was there in the front seat with me in the car, and then I put him in the back seat and maybe the trunk, and if we had kept on going, maybe not even in the car. And as we talked together, he became much more sobered. He saw how dangerous a place he'd been in, and in seeing that dangerous place, he saw how gracious God had been in rescuing him from that. And he began to focus on the kindness of God, the kindness that was unwilling to let a young man run away from him. And it was amazing to track the conversation over the course of the time we spent together. It went from why me as this complaint, in other words, I deserve better than this, to why me? A humble astonishment that God would be this good to him. You see, part of ministry involves helping people be surprised that God is so good to them that he refuses to lose his relationship with them, even if that means bringing suffering into their life in order to strengthen that relationship. If you can help people get hold of this bigger picture, they'll be more willing to endure patiently the trials that they go through. If you can help people get hold of this bigger picture, they'll be more willing to do what pleases God in the middle of their suffering. Third thing I'd like to draw your attention to in the book: you need to take action. The letter of 1 Peter is terribly practical. If all you do, and I invite you to do this sometime, take the book and write down every time Peter tells you to do something or not to do something, and you'll wind up with 2 full pages. It's amazing for how short a little book it is. Many of the action steps can be summarized under the heading of loving others. One way to love is not to return evil when you suffer. Peter tells you not to lie or be malicious, not to be deceitful, not to be slanderous or vengeful. But he also gives you positive exhortations to honor others, to seek to do good to them. And these are clear, practical ways of extending yourself to others in the same way that Christ has extended himself to you. And I'll leave that as an exercise for you, because I'd like to focus on something more internal. You see, Peter doesn't only talk about outward action-oriented things. He's also very concerned for what's taking place inside of you. That's a good thing, because you can't always stop people from hurting you. But you can handle the stuff that's going on inside of you because of what Christ has already done for you. I'm going to run through a list of 6 things that we'll unpack a little bit more in time. Here's the things that I see him telling us. He tells you, don't be surprised at what's happening to you when you suffer, chapter 4, verse 12. He tells you not to fear things that are frightening, chapter 3, verse 6 and verse 14, chapter 5, verse 7. He tells you not to be ashamed at having suffered, chapter 4, verse 16. Instead, more positively, you're supposed to rejoice, chapter 1, verse 6 and 8, chapter 4, verse 13. You're to be self-controlled and sober, chapter 4, verse 7, chapter 5, verse 8. And you're to decide that you are done with sin, chapter 1, verse 14, 2, 11, and 4, 1. And as I look at that list of things, I realize they address exactly my typical reactions to suffering. Let's go through them a little bit more at length. First, I tend to be surprised by suffering. When it happens to me, I tend to react with some variation of, hey, what's going on? I was doing the good thing, and look at what I'm getting back. I still go through life expecting that if I do good to other people, then they will too. You see, I'm still an American. I still have an American theology. It says bad things don't happen to good people. And Peter wakes me up by saying, don't be surprised. Don't be surprised at the suffering you're going through. It's possible to be surprised, but don't be. Put it a little more positively, Peter tells you, expect suffering. It's part of God's plan for your life. It's a mindset that you need to practice. When you try living God's way in this world, some people won't approve of it, and you will suffer for it. Expect it. Now, having told me to expect suffering, Peter also says, do not fear. It's striking how often he says that in this short book. And it makes perfect sense, since one of the primary things he's trying to get across is that I should expect suffering to take place. You see, if I start to believe that suffering is coming, I start to look over my shoulder for it. See, I don't like suffering. I don't know about you, but if I can see suffering coming, I'd like to get out of the way. And so I'm almost set up in a way, okay? Expect suffering. Well, now I'm looking for it. I'm set up to be afraid. It's a little bit like that saying, just because you're not paranoid doesn't mean they're not out to get you. You think about that long enough and you start to watch the person sitting next to you. If I'm expecting suffering, I'm tempted to live scared. And Peter understands that temptation. He reminds us that we're to entrust ourselves to God exactly like Jesus did. And in learning to trust God with the results of my life, the fear dissipates. Because I know He's big enough and willing enough to handle the ugly things that come my way, and I don't need to. I spent time talking with somebody once who was convinced, absolutely convinced, that everybody was watching him, following him, and out to ruin his life. And in talking together, we decided, let's talk about Jesus a little bit. Because Jesus had enemies who were out to ruin and destroy him, and yet he did something a little odd. He didn't spend any time trying to figure out who they were, or what they were up to, or how to avoid them. Instead, he kept right on doing what his Father had given him to do. And this fellow that I was talking with decided he was going to adopt the same approach. And he decided it didn't matter whether other people watched him or not. He was going to be consumed with living his life according to the will of God rather than consumed with safeguarding his life. And that young man taught me something about how not to live in fear. Next down on the list, don't be embarrassed at suffering for the sake of Christ. That's hard too. When you got beat up at school, you didn't want anybody to know that. When you're standing in a crowd and somebody puts you down, you kind of wish that the floor would open up and like you'd disappear or they would disappear, but somehow you'd get away from them. Suffering caused by other people exposes that they're stronger than you are. They're more powerful than you are. Your weakness is exposed when somebody can hurt you. You're shown to be at a disadvantage, and nobody likes that. And Peter doesn't say that you have to learn how to like that. He tells you, you don't need to be embarrassed or ashamed by it. Simply because you've been victimized by someone else doesn't mean that you're less of a person for it. You see, shame comes from believing that the way that you were taken advantage of in some way says the last word on who you are as a person. The way that you suffered. Shame comes from believing that the way that you suffered is the last word that's going to be spoken about you for all eternity. And if that were true, then Jesus is in really big trouble. See, he suffered brutally at the hands of others. He was ridiculed, mocked. Nobody stood up for him. He was stripped. He was hung up to die on a cross. and he was buried. If there was ever a person who could equate being victimized with being shamed, it was Jesus. And yet, that was not the last word on who Jesus is. Jesus was raised from the dead, exalted into heaven, and now waits for his enemies to be put under his feet. And when they're there, they will be silent. There will be a time when not a single voice in all of creation mocks Jesus for what he endured in his humiliation. He's not ashamed in heaven now because he knows the vindication of his judge is currently taking place and will one day be fully complete. He entrusted himself into the Father's hands and he knows what that outcome will be. You also have a faithful, righteous judge who will not let your exposed weakness be the last word said about you that lasts for all eternity. If you've been exposed and humiliated for the sake of honoring Christ, do not be ashamed, because your God will vindicate you. Speaking a little more positively, Peter tells you to rejoice. Rejoice. When I'm suffering, I grumble, I groan, I complain, I whine, I moan, I ask why me, but rejoice? That's not my typical repertoire. And again, Peter adjusts my eyes heavenward, and he makes me mindful of God. He makes me mindful of God's presence and his purposes. He reminds me that if Christ is willing to suffer for me, if there was no other way for me to be reconciled to the Father, then that Christ the Son would die. And Christ did that, entrusting himself into the Father's hand. Then I too can entrust myself into the Father's hand when I suffer, knowing that it is also necessary and for a good purpose. How else do I handle suffering? Well, I don't tend to be very controlled in my reactions. See, I don't like suffering. And if you make me suffer, I will let you know in such a way that I don't like it, so that you'll think twice before doing it again. Now, some of us do this in a loud and nasty kind of way. Others of us are more bitter and cold. But both of those modes, whether you're more aggressive or more passive, both of those are reactionary, right? They don't require any thought. They don't require you to spend a lot of time figuring out how to do it or strategize. You just do it. You just react. And Peter cuts against this tendency in all of us by calling us to be sober and self-controlled. Sober and self-controlled. That's a little hard to hear in a society that's elevated venting to an art form. Peter reminds us, however, that we don't simply live in this society, but we live in God's world, and we live under his judgment. We don't simply react to others to back them off. But I realize that under God's gaze, this is an opportunity to do good to others in the same way that Christ has done good to me. It's an opportunity to show the depths of what Christ has done in me. It's an opportunity to experience his presence near to me. Lastly, when I suffer, I want to respond in kind. I want to give back at least as much as I've been given. Okay, revenge makes sense to me. Returning evil for evil makes sense to me. Talking bad about you when you slander me makes sense to me. And it also makes sense to you. Okay, think about the last time that you were cut off on the highway. Okay, whether you're the more fist-shaking, swearing sort of person, probably not in this room, I understand that. Or you're the more condescending, head-shaking, grit-your-teeth sort of person. You understand instinctively and unconsciously what it's like to sit in judgment over somebody else. And you understand instinctively how to return evil for evil. And Peter tells you in so many words, it's time for you to be done with sin. You've spent enough time in the past in sin. It's time to be done with it. You need to decide. It's no longer an option. It's not okay to excuse your bad reactions. It's not okay to minimize them based on what somebody else has done. It's not okay to blame shift. It's time to be done with sin. And that idea is something that needs to be set firmly in your heart and in your mind. These six ways of dealing internally with suffering: not being surprised, not fearing, not being ashamed, rejoicing, being self-controlled, and being done with sin. These are not typical. They're atypical. typical reactions all place me at the center of my world. I know what's best for me, and I'll take care of me. Atypical reactions all place Christ at the center. He knows what's best for me, and I trust him because of what he's done, because of where he's going, and now I live in accordance with his commands. And that's what makes all the difference in how you respond to suffering. Who's at the center, you or Christ? You're going to suffer in this world when you do right. How you react to that suffering depends on your relationship and closeness with Christ. Peter sums up all the different themes that we've been talking about today in chapter 4, verse 19, where he says, "Let those who suffer according to God's will entrust their souls to a faithful Creator while doing good." Let those who suffer according to God's will entrust their souls to a faithful Creator while doing good. Let's pray. God, give us faith to repent. Over the many times that we have thought you too little or too small to obey you, forgive us for not caring enough to have your presence near us. Forgive us for returning evil for evil instead of being the children that you've made us to be. Give us your kindness, Lord, that we might draw near to you, that we might be people who long to be near you, to have you near us as we do good to others who sin against us. In Jesus' name, amen.